Okay, so as I mentioned last week, if you haven't registered, then there's a trapdoor underneath your chair. So please make sure that you sign in each week, and if your name is not on the list, it means you're not registered. You got to go to the office, fill out the form absolutely completely. You can lie through your teeth about your birth date, which you have to put one. So please make sure you sign in. Everybody that's just coming in, make sure that you register, you put your name, you check by your name. And again, if your name isn't on that list, please go to the office after class and fill out a registration form. But if you're not registered, you still have to put your name there so I know you were here. But then I can't record that you were here until you are registered.
All right, so enough of that.
Announcements.
It is helpful.
I know it's helpful, but I hate it. Okay, Mind Supermind is on November 4th. Doctors Bradley Weininger and Michael Kearney in this room get tickets in advance because they're very well known in the community and well loved in the community. This evening, Dr. Gay Hendricks is at the Marjorie Lynn Theater. Many of you know about Gay Hendricks. He's done amazing work in psychology. People are just coming in. You can't come in unless you register. I mean, unless you sign in, okay? Sign in, please. The Mind, Body, and Soul series continues this coming Tuesday at the Marjorie Lynn Theater. And I think it's Dave Vogel's second talk. Is that right?
The second talk was this week.
No,
oh, this week.
It's a blonde woman long hair, about intentions.
Oh, that the woman about intention. Got it. I don't. Kim Terranova.
Terranova.
Yeah. I don't know how I remember that. But anyway, so that's the talk this Tuesday at Mind, Body, and Soul. Just to remind you, coming up is Peter Wright's. Peter is, as many of you know, a member of our class and an eminent hypnotherapist, and he's got a two-part class coming up starting on Saturday, the 19th of October, called Get Guidance from Your Higher Self, where you actually go into trance and you talk to your higher self, and your higher self gives you guidance, and it's a pretty valuable and wonderful thing to do, and Peter's the person who leads you. So you might want to register in advance. I don't know if he's got an upper limit on that, but you don't want to get shut out of that. So register in advance. That's on Saturday. The first of the two sessions is Saturday the 19th.
Flyers are on the table.
Oh, and the flyers are on the table. And the second session is the week after. So this is the 19th and the 26th of October. The art fair in this class is on November 8th, which is our last class of the term. So bring your artwork, put it around the room. We'll have an art fair as well as a class. And don't be shy. Whatever you produce, first of all, there is no objective standard that I can figure out for any of this stuff. So somebody will love it, somebody will hate it, somebody will think it's great, and it doesn't really matter. If you want to test that out, have your dog walk across the paper and put it up, and I'm sure somebody will frame it.
What's
this? David Kuhn comes next week, and his subject. So he's going to be here next week, and his talk is going to be, the subject is going to be the nature of healing and the consciousness of nature. Because as many of you know, Dave is extremely hooked into the natural world and has done stuff like found an organization called Inward Bound. We take people out into nature to have mystic experiences, essentially. So Dave is really remarkable in a lot of respects, but the two subjects he's going to talk about, the nature of healing, he's particularly it's particularly suited for him to talk about those because he's a healer in two very different, he's a doctor in two very different traditions. So we kind of can see the parallels between these two traditions. Western medicine, don't get excited. Western medicine and South African shamanism. And then consciousness and nature, that's really what he is. It's another thing that he knows exquisitely well. Okay, so questions?
I just mentioned that Peter Wright's second class is only from 9 to 10, so you can make David Coombs' class from 10 to 12 the same day.
Oh,
so there's no conflict.
Oh, really? So that's on the 26th?
Your second class.
Yeah. Oh, so, okay, so I see. So Peter's class is 1 hour, and then Dave's class just follows right that.
Peter's first class is 2 hours.
Yeah.
My second
class is 1 hour, and then I got it. Okay. Good.
Okay.
So that's my announcements. Are there any announcements from the group? I've seen none. I'll talk a little bit about mindfulness and sit. Today's class is focused primarily on the body. The first thing I'm going to show you is not particular. Well, it sort of is, but not so explicitly as the second thing I'm going to show you. But I thought that following what we talked about last week, which was when you sit in mindfulness, you pay attention not only to what you're thinking and to what you're sensing, but also to what you're feeling, to your emotions. And for many of us, that's kind of territory we used to inhabit, but we have long since left. And so it's kind of interesting to gradually recover emotional experience as you sit. So I want to extend that even further and talk about the body in consciousness and in psychology. A very brief history of psychology, or scientific psychology, started 130 or 140 years ago, and even at the very beginning of psychology, the focus was on sensation and how we assemble sensation with perception. That was William Wundt. In 1879 in Leipzig, Germany, the first official psychology laboratory. And then in the United States, starting in 1915, that tradition of focusing on the body in 1915 in the United States, something called behaviorism started. The idea was, okay, I gotta go back a little further. So what Wilhelm Wundt was trying to do in his laboratory was asking people by introspection to figure out the components of their mental experience. So by looking inside, how do you put together a perception? How do you put together an impression of something? And that failed. People were not very good at describing their internal experience. And then Sigmund Freud and colleagues talked about this stuff like the id, the ego, and the superego, these putative parts of the mind that don't actually exist, but they're kind of symbolic. And so the scientific community kind of felt like this is all stuff we can't measure. It's all subjective stuff, not objective stuff. And we're scientific. We measure that which is objective, that which everybody can agree on. So those early attempts to kind of understand the mind from inside were rejected by scientific psychology. And starting in 1915 with John Broadus Watson and behaviorism, psychology decided that they would only study that which everybody could observe. So we were going to ignore everything that went on inside the individual. That was all thrown out of psychology, and instead we were only going to observe behavior, because everybody could agree on the external behaviors. So behaviorism became the dominant theme in psychology throughout most of the 20th century. The idea is rewards and punishments from the environment cause differences in your behavior. The most prominent advocate of this was B.F. Skinner at Harvard. He wrote a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity about the idea that these things that are in your mind have nothing to do with how you actually behave. It's all what's coming at you from outside that determines your behavior. And that the best we can do is create manipulative situations that manipulate people in the right ways rather than the wrong ways. And that held sway in psychology firmly until about 1970, when the cognitive revolution happened,
And suddenly we realize that if you want to talk about a human being, you have to talk about something more than behavior. They actually thought. And furthermore, their thinking had something to do with their behavior. That is, for one person, something that like that out there was rewarding, and for another person who thought differently, that thing out there was punishing. So in order to understand behavior, you had to understand how you were interpreting the things that were coming at you. And that was the cognitive revolution, and then up until very recently, that was what psychology focused on, which is how you process information, how you're like a computer. So now what we have is a psychology of behavior and a psychology of thinking. And until very recently, that was the whole deal of psychology. But you being human beings, so there's something missing there, which is we don't exist only from the neck up and from the skin out. We actually have something going on inside us. And so just recently, psychologists have decided that emotions, strange and woo-woo and uncomfortable as they sometimes are actually worthy of study. And that's starting to creep back into scientific psychology, is what are these emotion things? And we've talked a lot about that in this class. But the very latest thing to creep into psychology with emotionality is the idea that the body has something to do with who you are. And that, Bessie's laughing because some people have known this for a long time. She's a Feldenkrais practitioner, that's what they do. But scientific psychology always looked at stuff like this tapping stuff, you know, the emotional freedom technique, as like beyond the pale, stupid, you know, until it became evident that not only was it effective, but there was actually scientific reason for why body-focused approaches made a difference. And so now we have something called somatic psychology, which is moving into scientific creeds and study. And so people, when they work with you these days about many things that you want to work on, they don't just work on your thoughts. And they don't just work on your feelings, they work on your body. Because the body really is integral in how you behave. Many of you know this. If you have trauma, and you go to somebody who's trained in trauma, they're not primarily going to talk to you. They're going to talk to you and they're going to do various kinds of body work. And I think that probably for severe trauma, there's no way that talk alone will clear that trauma. I think it's stored in the body and it has to be cleared in the body. And when I refer people, I always ask or make sure that I refer them to somebody that is a somatic psychologist as well as a cognitive and behavioral psychologist, somebody that knows the whole range. So, that's all preamble to first what we're going to do today, but secondly to the mindfulness. So what I suggest you do in this mindfulness sitting, in this 10 minutes, is first, when you focus on your breathing, I guess I need to say a tiny bit more. When you focus on your breathing, most of us just kind of get a kind of a loose sense of our breathing. I suggest you get a very precise sense of your breathing. And ask yourself, what is moving when I breathe? And you can kind of do this with me now. So what is moving when you breathe? Well, the thing that most of us will feel most pronouncedly is the belly rising and falling, moving in and out. By the way, if your belly is not moving and you've got it frozen, your thoracic breathing, you're trying to breathe with your chest, it's inefficient and exhausting. What you need to do is soften your belly. Nobody's watching, you know, so that it can move in and out, and in and out. And when it does that, the diaphragm goes up and down and you breathe diaphragmatically, that's proper. So the most pronounced part of the breathing motion, as you pay attention to it, is the movement of your belly. And that shows you that you're breathing diaphragmatically. But that's not the only thing moving when you breathe. Air moves in and out of your nostrils, and you could actually put a hand there. Or you can just feel that the air moves in and out of your nostrils, right? So now we got your belly going up and down, and we got the air coming in and out, and maybe your mouth, if it's slightly open, the air comes in and out there. But that's not all that's moving. Pay attention to your neck, shoulders, and upper back. Do they move slightly when you breathe? If you notice, you'll notice with your in-breath, those things rise and open. So I'm exaggerating. But that's a subtle motion that you can't miss if you really pay attention. So the belly's going in and out a lot. The air is coming in and out of the nostrils, obviously. And the shoulders, neck, head, and back are kind of going like they're rising with the in-breath, falling with the out-breath. It's like the whole front of your body is opening a little and closing a little. And actually, if you're really sensitive, you understand that your arms and hands are turning out a little with the in-breath and turning in a little with the out-breath. And if you're really, really, really sensitive, you can feel that your legs and feet actually open slightly with the out-breath and close slightly, no, the other way around, with the in-breath and close slightly with the out-breath. So it's like your whole body's a bellows, going like this and going like this. And your chest, it turns out, moves very subtly. Doesn't move much at all, but it does open and close very slightly. So if I asked you to pay attention only to your breathing, there would be a lot to pay attention to. And in fact, in very traditional settings where they teach Vipassana meditation, they ask you to pay attention to your breathing for very long periods of time and nothing else. They say, forget about everything else, just focus on your breathing so you get a real good sense of your breathing, which you can then come back to over and over again. But I'm not going to ask that of you because it's totally boring. It's not totally boring, but it's not ideal. Okay, so first, when you start to become mindful, first thing you do is you focus on your breathing, and you notice what's moving, and you just become very sensitive to those movements. And then what I suggest we do this today, in the 10-minute sitting that we're going to do, is focus on how your entire body feels. Those of you who talk energy, focus on the energy of your body. If you don't like that way of talking about it, feel how the vitality of your body is distributed. Feel that your whole body is alive and there is vitality in every section of it. And that you can feel every section of your body. So you're looking inside, you're using the insular cortex, part of the top of your brain, to look at your body and to just sense where it is and how it feels. And then a third thing, so first breathing, second focus on the body and how it feels, and then the third thing is use your entire body as a sense organ. So when you're sensing thoughts, feelings, sounds, other sensations, you're sensing those things with your entire body, not just with your head. So the awareness isn't coming from your head alone. It's coming from your entire organism. So the whole body is sensing. Okay? So 1, 2, 3. Breathe. Notice that, the subtleties of breathing. Second, notice the feeling of aliveness in the whole body. And third, notice whatever you notice using your whole body as a sense organ. So your whole body is doing the perceiving. All right, so let's sit for 10 minutes. By the way, please turn off your cell phones if they're on. So it doesn't really matter, you know, because when you're sitting, there are no distractions. There are just things to pay attention to. And if you get upset about various things, then you pay attention to the fact that you're upset. So in mindfulness is something you can do in any setting, because the object is just to be aware and okay with whatever's happening. All right, so let's sit.
two announcements I didn't make at the beginning. One of which is, if you want to listen to any of these lectures and other programs again, or if you miss one, you can go to swt.org/Spencer, and they are recorded by Michael Hegelwald and then put by Robert Bernstein onto that, and so they're available for you. I have no idea what the second thing. What?
Can you repeat that?
SWT.org/Spencer has pretty much all the classes that have happened for years for you to be able to listen to. Liam?
I didn't find the very first class. Is that just not there?
The very first class of this term.
Yeah.
There was a technical difficulty. I'm sorry. I could blame Sony for making the recorder, but I'll take the responsibility. It's out there in the universe. But
I do also keep detailed notes, so if there's some class you really want to know, email me. And I'll send you my notes. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So this is Robert Bernstein, and if you need his email.
Well, it's there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, you email him there. Yeah. Okay. So, Annie, you had a question or a comment.
What would you say about the experience in mindfulness where everything is coherent, where your body is absolutely breathing as one whole, and then entering into a kind of liminal space where lucid dreaming begins to lose holding patterns? That's my experience.
I would say to let that happen.
Yeah.
And be aware as possible as it unfolds.
Yeah. I
would say that there are levels and levels of consciousness that appear to one as one opens more and more, and that the instruction is always to experience them fully, appreciate them deeply, and not hold on to them. I don't know what the second announcement was. No idea. Michael.
Yesterday, for the first time, I did a mindfulness guided meditation with a hospice patient of mine who was transitioning. She had about 3 days to live, and she was non-responsive, but we always assume that they can hear. So for my benefit and for her, mostly his pain management, because she was suffering from all kinds of horrible things over the last 10 years, and it just all came together in a perfect storm. Her pain was being managed, essentially, but I could feel from sitting with her for a couple hours that there was just this big, thing going on with her inside. And so I just gently guided her through this, and I could feel like a shift in her overall, like kind of discomfort. So, and it certainly helped me. So.
Thank you, Spencer.
You know, even your presence is always affects other people. So if you change how you are, it will change any situation that you're in. And sometimes in ways that are surprising and that you wouldn't otherwise perceive. Okay, so the first thing that I want to do is show you just a 2.5-minute video clip. Because I promised you at the end of last week that I would leave you on an affirmative note, and I didn't, because there wasn't enough time. So this is what I would have showed to you at the end of last session. I'm going to show it to you now before I take you deeper into our investigation of how the body and the mind are one thing. Okay? So we need to, for this, you really need to see it well, because it's about photography. So let's leave the window open, but let's close off, leave the windows open, but close all the red drapes. So we have pretty dark rooms. Mm-hmm.
What's it called? It's called.
Okay, so this is just a let me get the slide here. This is just a little something from the news.
Finally tonight, just when it seems the world is falling apart, along comes a man who's out to bring us all together. Steve Hartman met him on the ring.
46-year-old Richard Rinaldi is looking for someone. Two someones, actually. Two total strangers who were meant to be together.
This is Dominic, right?
If only for a moment.
Okay, so you guys are going to be a couple.
They're not exactly what I just signed up for.
Actually,
and people are a little nervous at first.
I just need you a little closer. Like, okay, good.
Richard is a New York photographer working on a series of portraits.
Okay, good.
For each shot, he grabs strangers off the street, like Jenny Wood, an airline employee from Virginia, and Dominic Tucker, a college student from Brooklyn. And poses them like a door in family.
Beautiful. 1, 2, and 3.
Richard calls the project Touching Strangers. He started shooting it 7 years ago and now has hundreds of portraits of these unlikely intimates. Some of the photos, you'd never know, they'd never met. While others capture quite well the inherent awkwardness of projects. Even when the subjects seem eager, their body language often concedes a certain hesitance, at least at first. 10 minutes later, though, it's like Thanksgiving at Aunt Martin's. That's a really weird thing.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, Richard puts the people in these poses, but the sentiment that seems to shine through is real. At least, so say the subjects.
Okay.
It was sort of awkward, but then sort of not.
You guys are so good.
We are probably missing so much about the people all around us.
This is Rico.
At first, Ryan Steve, a poetry teacher, saw no rhyme or reason for posing with retired fashion designer Rico Irwin.
Can you just come in like a little more? Yeah, okay.
But eventually, he too felt a change.
I felt like I cared for her.
Cared for her?
Yes, I felt like I wrote that on barriers.
Pretty much everyone shared that same sentiment.
It was nice to feel that comfort.
Everyone seems to have come away with kind of a good feeling. It's kind of lovely. It's lovely.
Most photographers capture life as it is. But in these strangers, Richard Rinaldi has captured something much more ethereal and elusive. He shows us humanity as it could be, as most of us wish it would be, and as it was. At least for this one fleeting moment in time. Steve Hartman, on the road, in New York.
Molly has published his stories in a book called...
Isn't that amazing? Okay. Rinaldi, I guess. Okay, so to find that, you go to New York City Photographer. Let me get one light on here so I can see what I'm doing.
I have the exact title.
Steve, what?
New York Photographer Turning Perfect Strangers into Perfect Subjects.
Yes, that's it. New York Photographer Turning Perfect Strangers into Perfect Subjects. And it's YouTube.
You can also see something very similar in Venice Beach in Los Angeles. I had a friend with a vine about 20 years ago, and he would do the same thing over like 20 minutes with the crowd and create a family portrait of what he would even take babies from, you know, the parents and put them there. And it was beautiful, and it was fluid and dynamic.
People long for kids. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is... I'm going to take you to, again, we're going to need it fairly dark. Let's darken it. So I'm going to take you to Melbourne, Australia, to the 6th World Congress of Positive Psychology, which took place in July of this year. And this is a talk from that session or series of sessions. And it's about something that most of you know something about, but this guy is a preeminent researcher talking about the very latest understandings. Okay? I'm not going to tell you what it is until I get it up there. Okay? It'll take me a moment to fish this out, but I will. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop this at several points in his presentation. This is a very good presentation. By the way, there's no closed captioning on it, but he speaks very well and there's a lot of illustrations. But I'll stop it every once in a while and say, here's what he just said, or here's what you especially want to pay attention to. But this is an academic presentation. So, I need to go to...
He received that many awards that I found when I was in school, otherwise you won't have the memory and I'll be standing here for hours. But I'd just like to mention a couple. First of all, he had a Researcher of the Year award from his own university in 2012. So he was a very famous researcher. But one of the beautiful things of his work is that he also had an award to be one of the best research communicators. So that's in 2017. So that's not too long ago, so he can communicate his research and the outcomes of it very well. He also got a Dutch award, which I want to announce, of course, from the University of Utrecht in the middle of our country in 2013. And he has many other international collections because he also was recently honored by the Greek University of Antwerpen in Belgium. So that's every different country altogether in his work. And he's currently the president of the European Behavioral Pharmacological Society. And I wish and I hope you can help me in giving him a warm welcome for his talk on a gut feeling about happiness.
Thank you. Okay, good morning, everyone. These lights are bright. Thank you, Mika, for the very kind words and very kind introduction. And thanks to the wonderful Leo Waters for inviting me here to Melbourne. As Mika said, I was here in Melbourne for 15 months, but it's 21 years ago, and I haven't been back to Australia since, so it's been really great to have this opportunity. And when I travel, as I do a lot, I have to remind people a little bit of some of the geography. Is there a pointer? No. Okay, so a little bit of geography. Just bear with me. No, maybe the pointer doesn't work. But up here at the top is Ireland. And Ireland is just worth pointing out because just to remind people that we're not part of the United Kingdom. We're not united or a kingdom. So most people know where Ireland is, but many people don't know where Cork is. And this is all you need to know about the geography of Ireland. Cork is Ireland's second city down in the very south. And you know, I was thinking when I came here about maps. Maps are interesting because they're all about perspective. So we could also show the map of the world this way, which is the Australian view of the map of the world, with Melbourne very nicely on top here. And so sometimes it's good to turn things upside down, and you get to see things in a new way. And that's what I want to share with you today, is about how, what if we take what we know about the brain and turn it upside down and think about it from the gut perspective. And I have small kids, and especially when they were younger, when I tell them bedtime stories, sometimes my mind would wander and I start to look for parallels between these stories and my professional life. And you all know the story of Pinocchio. It's the story of a puppet who was formed by the puppeteer Geppetto. And Pinocchio required Geppetto for his appropriate formation and airy life. And then he goes and has many adventures and misadventures, but Geppetto's never too far away to help guide him along this. And hopefully I can convince you in this short talk that there might be parallels between what's going on in our brain, Pinocchio, and what's going on in our gut, Geppetto. And it can be quite surprising, especially to my neuroscience and neuropsychology colleagues, to think about the gut when we consider brain. But all we have to do is go back to the founder of modern medicine in some ways, it's Hippocrates. And Hippocrates is thought to have said, although it could be fake news because there's no real documentation of this, but he's supposed to have said that all diseases begin in the gut. And this is quite striking when you think about psychiatric or neurological syndrome. But all we have to do also is look to our language. We use phrases like gut feelings, gut instincts. When we're brave, we make gutsy moves. When we're disappointed, we're gutted. When we are nervous, we have butterflies in our tummy. So perhaps there is an underlying biology to all of this. And my research over two decades now, the one factor that has been a constant in all of that is we're trying to understand the impact that stress has on our brain and on our body. And I don't have to tell you, even in wonderful Australia, that we are living in a stressful world. My desk on a good day looks like that. All we have to do is just, you know, turn on our television, then we get more stress. All one of the worst types of stresses are having anticipatory stress and not knowing what's going to happen in the future. And again, in Europe and in Ireland in particular, we're looking very lonely in this redrawn map of Europe. But when I talk about stress, and I really talk about chronic stress or traumatic stress, one of my take-home messages for you is that it is a whole body syndrome. It doesn't just affect a few neurons within the hippocampus and the brain. Now, we've studied these neurons, they're wonderful, but it affects our immune system. And how our immune system talks to our brain. It affects even locally in our gut, changing gut barrier function and driving a pro-inflammatory phenotype. And one of the big factors in stress research in general goes back to the saying from Hans Selye, who's the father of stress research and coined the term stress. And Selye says that it's not stress that kills us, but it's our reaction to it. And so why, on this roller coaster of life, if two people are subjected to the same stressors, why do they react differently? And a lot of stress research has focused on susceptibility factors. But over the last few years, there's been a growing appreciation of resilience and resilience factors. And again, this is where positive psychology is really playing a big role. And what are, you know, what is driving this, that when we all turn on our TVs, that we all don't suffer from a stress-related disorder? We know that genetics is really important in this regard. The growing field of epigenetics is also important. But what if it's something else? What if it's also to do with what's going on in our gut, in the microbes in our gut? And why would I say that? Well, I say that because of studies we've done for over a decade now, starting out initially in animal models, where we've shown that adverse early events, stressful events, changes the microbiome. So basically that we showed in an animal model of early life adversity that there was a signature of this trauma that persisted in the microbiome all the way into adulthood. We showed this also in other models of stress across the lifespan. And so it began to really increase.
Okay, so. First majorly important point that he makes. He's going to make it again, but I want to underline it now. First of all, the microbiome is stuff in your gut, the bacteria in your gut, and he's going to talk about how many there are and how diverse they are. But what he's saying is, in animal models, they do it in animals, not in humans, but then they assume that much of the same thing is going to happen in humans. What they do is they stress animals early in their life, and then they see the effect on the microbiome. And it turns out that early trauma persists in its effect on the microbiome throughout the whole life. I see he's going to say more about this.
Appreciates that there was a clear link between stress and these microbes that we have in our gut. So, what are these microbes? What is the microbiome? And what do I need to tell you? Well, the first thing I need to tell you and remind you is that we are living in a microbial world. The microbes were here long before humans. Long. What's also important to remind you in terms of genes, we are more than 99% microbial. That's quite humbling. If you think of all the money we spend on the Human Genome Project, and for less than 1% of our genes. The weight of our gut microbes is roughly about the same as our brain. Also very humbling for me as a neuroscientist. If I'd given this talk a few years ago, I would have told you we have, and you'll see this written a lot, 10 times more microbial cells than human cells. But this is a very fast-moving field. Advances in sequencing technologies and algorithm development and computational biology are changing all the time. So that has been revised downwards. So now we're talking about 1.3 to 1. So in terms of cells, we're still more microbial, but just about.
Okay. So what he just said is the weight of the bacteria in your gut is about the same as the weight of your brain, so about 3 pounds. And the bacteria in your gut contain about 99% of the genes that are in your body. Okay? And he also said that current estimates of how many bacteria there are is about 40 trillion. The current estimate of how many cells we have that are not microbial, they're not bacterial, is about 37. There are about 37 trillion cells that are human cells in your body, and there are slightly more than that, about 40 trillion bacterial cells in your body, and they work together. You can't live without it's a synergy. You can't live without the bacteria. It's a symbiosis.
So just think, the next time you go to the bathroom and you get rid of some of your microbes, that you're becoming more human, and what that might mean. What we're really interested in my lab is trying to understand the impact that these microbes have on brain function at key time windows across the lifespan. I already mentioned in the perinatal period in terms of area-wide diversity of Caucasian adolescents and in aging. And trying to understand these is a big part of where our research program is going right now. And so where does it all begin? Well, for the most part, we're taught to be sterile in utero. And we get our frontier microbes as we are being born. They become, as we are delivered through the birth canal, they become a kind of a birthday present from our mothers on our day of birth.
So you got that? You don't have microbes in your gut in utero. Only at your birth did they come in, because now you're going to be fed externally. So it's a birthday present from your mom. So this immediately, in many of you, would raise certain questions. Like what happens if you're born by C-section, for example? And he's going to talk about that. And what happens if your mom is not very happy when she's carrying you? Does that affect her microbiome? And does then that affect the microbiome that you receive? And as we talked about, some of these early influences persist throughout lifetime.
In a way, they're handed over from mother to infant in an evolutionary relay race. And these microbes then inform the development of the immune system and gut health and the programming of many of the systems in our bodies. So many factors that it can influence these microbes in early life have the potential to alter this programming. Among them is the mode of nutritional provision. Breastfeeding has a different effect than bottle feeding. Prematurity, I already mentioned stress, but also maternal infection, the environment we live in, exposure to antibiotics, the hospital environment. And even though I poo-pooed genetics earlier, there's a really exciting interest in the relationship between host genetics and the microbiome, especially in early life, and how that programs overall. But one of the interesting factors that influences the microbiome is also the mode of delivery at birth. Because if you're born by C-section, as about a third of this audience will have been or thereabouts, you bypass this handover, you get a different microbiome. And this was shown in this classic study from Domingos Bello and colleagues, showing that the microbiome of infants born by C-section is quite different to those born vaginally. And then more recently, in a paper just in Nature, in the last year, in a large study of 12,000 people, have shown again that a mode of delivery really differentiates the microbiome in early life. And they refer to the microbiome as a kind of a nature security blanket overall. And we know that being born by C-section increases your relative risk of allergy, asthma, type 1 diabetes, and people are beginning to explore the relationship with the microbiome and driving it. We know very little about it in the context of stress or brain health. And we've been working on an animal model to try and work on this, and we've shown that there are distinct enduring effects of being born by C-section that persist throughout life. They're subtle, but they're there in terms of stress and in terms of social behavior. But that's in mice. But what about humans? Could we test this in humans? And so we did an experiment that we never thought would really work, but we got the grant, so we did it. And we wanted to look at, could we ethically stress humans in the lab? And we have a great way of doing that. Well-validated test called the Trier Social Stress Test, where people are brought in and they have to give a public speech based around a pitch for their dream job in front of very angry-looking people in white coats. And then there's a trick arithmetic test, and everything is monitored in terms of their biological and psychological responses to the stress. And so we took, and I was going to say normal, but Irish medical students and their mode of delivery to see how they respond. And much to our surprise, we were able to see that, especially in relation to the immune and psychological response to an acute stress, that those born by C-section had a greater stress response. Quite intriguing. But that's acute stress. Then what about chronic stress? Can we ethically, chronically stress individuals? Well, that's what's great about being an educator. We do this all the time by making our students sit exams. And so we're able to monitor how they respond against in biological and psychological terms across the exam stress period. And we found quite remarkably, especially in relation to perceived stress and using the Cohen's perceived stress scale, we find that there's an elevation in terms of the stress response during the chronic exam period in those individuals born by C-section. Now, of course, C-section is many more things than just the microbiome, the stress of being born, there's the immune priming, etc. But it really helps us build a case that in early life that you want to mind your microbes as much as possible and look for ways to try and do that overall.
Okay, so you heard that, but just to reiterate, what he said is if you're born by C-section, you're more likely to have allergies, asthma, and type 1 diabetes. And your stress response to both acute and chronic stress is likely to be greater. Okay? And about a third of people in that audience, so about probably a third of us, are born by C-section.
Now, that's some of the evidence that we have, but my neuroscience colleagues are a very skeptical bunch. And they really still, we're trained in neuroscience to think of everything from the neck upwards. That's how medicine is compartmentalized. And so I still have to come up with evidence that the microbiome might be relevant to brain, especially in early life. And in biology and engineering in general, perhaps the best way to find out if something is important is to take it out and see what happens. So the concept of being germ-free without microbes isn't new at all. It's something that goes back to Pasteur's time. Here you can see a germ-free man from the 1920s in a sci-fi magazine. We work with germ-free animals, in this case germ-free mice, who look a lot better than this, but they have their own problems, and they grow up in a bubble. Now, they don't have any really human translation, with the possible exception being the boy in the bubble that Paul Simon sang about in the 1980s. These mice in the bubble allow us to ask the question, is the microbiome involved, yes or no? And over many, many years now, many studies, we've been able to show that the microbiome is critically involved in sculpting brain circuits in early life. And you don't need to be a neuroscientist to show, be able to see here quite clearly in our germ-free animal, this is a basolateral amygdala neuron. We see a complete arborization. It's almost like it's completely stressed already compared to control.
Well, let me get a little further so you can see this.
Other factors we found with the hippocampal neurogenesis, the birth of new neurons.
Okay, so what he's saying here is the two neurons you're seeing are a control neuron and then a neuron from the germ-free mice. The germ-free mice neuron has more branches, see? So that would seem good, except this is in the amygdala, which is the alarm bell. So what he's saying is, in the germ-free mice, the amygdala is more likely to set off fight-or-flight messages. It's more likely to sound the alarm. He's also saying that in the hippocampus, which is right next to the amygdala, which has to do with memory, that and also with making new cells, neurogenesis, that there are changes that you see in the hippocampus also, and he didn't say it, but I think what he would say is there's less neurogenesis in the hippocampus in these germ-free mice. There's a less likely to make new brain cells. Oh, I guess I'll tell you this now, because he's not going to mention this study, but there's a famous study where they took genetically two strains of mice, a genetically bold strain and a genetically anxious, scared strain, okay? And what they did is they gave the genetically scared strain antibiotics to clear out the gut microbiome. And then they injected, or they put into the genetically, these mice that were scared, you know, genetically scared mice who, what do you call them, not scared, genetically timid mice, okay? They take the antibiotics and they clear out the gut microbiome of these mice, and then they put into these mice the bacteria from the genetically bold mice into the gut of the genetically timid mice, and the genetically timid mice become genetically become bold. They lose their anxiety. They're anxiety mice that become non-anxious just by substituting the microbiome of the bold mice.
Medication, I like
that. Okay, well, wait till you see how that medication, he's going to talk about that medication in a minute.
Is that a fecal transplant?
It's coming. Oh, it's coming, sorry. Okay. I don't want you to give the.
Is that what you're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. I don't want you to give the punchline away because it's a cool punchline. Okay, so here we go. So this is kind of important.
Okay.
So it seems as though, he's going to talk more about this, but it seems as though what's in your gut has a great deal to do with whether you are anxious or depressed. A great deal. So let's let him talk about it.
And the other thing that we found that was quite remarkable is that in relation to myelin. Now you may know about myelin because it's the insulation here on the right. That allows for appropriate nerve conductance. If you don't have myelin, as you see here on the left, signals don't get wired correctly. And that's what happens, for example, in multiple sclerosis. You have a demyelination occurring. So we looked in the prefrontal cortex, down the microscope, the electron microscope, in these animals, and what we found was that there was hypermyelination going on in these animals. And that was quite a remarkable finding for us. In terms of what behaviors this transmitted to, it was deficits in social behavior, elevated stress responses, and changes in fear memory responses. And it really gives us clear evidence that during early life we need appropriate microbes for appropriate brain development. So let's get to adults. Those of you, adolescence is a really important time in terms of psychological development and brain development. Those of you with teenagers will know that the anatomy of the teenage brain is quite different than that of the adults or the young kids. And it's probably one of the most exciting areas in all of neuroscience right now, especially in biological psychiatry, where we're trying to understand what's going on during this period in terms of how nerve cells communicate with the rest of the body. But it's really a brain that's under construction still, and we, as we go into extended adolescence, reaching out into the early 20s now, this has become critically important for in relation to the development of a variety of problems that emerge in adolescence. In the adolescent field, there's a lot.
Okay, so just because some of you can't read that, these are the times at which these difficulties develop. Impulse control disorders from 5 to about 15, anxiety disorders from 5 to 18 or 20. This is when these disorders first come to prominence. So very early. Schizophrenia from about 12 to 22 or 23. That's a narrower window than I have learned previously. But late teenage years, and anybody that works in a residential facility in a college is taught to look for the symptoms of the onset of schizophrenia because it will happen to 1% of the students. It's about 1% prevalence throughout the culture, throughout the whole world, actually. Mood disorders from about 15 to about 35 or 37. Substance use disorders, you have to be old enough to use substances. I'm sure that's going to move down, but now it's about 12 or 13 to about 25. So these things first evidence themselves pretty early in the teenage years.
A lot of focus then on factors like stress, alcohol, poor nutrition, inadequate sleep, drugs abuse, etc., all of which affect the brain. But what's not really studied so much yet is that all of these factors also affect the entire body, but have the ability to impinge on what's going on in terms of microbial composition. And slowly, slowly, they were beginning to realize that they are impacting how the microbiome is then talking.
Okay, so these are the factors that can negatively affect the teenage brain, but also negatively affect the teenage gut. Alcohol, inadequate sleep, and for teenagers, that's a particular problem, as you know. There's a move to get to start school later because kids are not, and to reduce the amount of homework because kids are not getting enough sleep. Poor nutrition, come on, you know what the teenage diet is, you know. Drugs of abuse and stress. So these things affect not only your brain, but the gut, and the gut and the brain are all wired together, as you're going to see.
To the brain, and that's something that we feel is really important. We need to do more things, especially in terms of educational programs, in terms of dietary advice that might be a key way of looking at the microbiome. Now I'm just going to go to aging, and I want to mention Eli Metchnikoff. Most of you have never probably heard of him, but he's one of the heroes in this field. He was a Russian working at the Pasteur Institute, and he was one of the fathers of modern immunology. And he won the Nobel Prize for his great work in immunology. But as often happens, great scientists, later on in their careers, they can start coming up with crazy ideas. And Metchnikoff was full of crazy ideas, most of them completely common. But one of his ideas was, why do people in what's now rural Bulgaria, why do they live longer and healthier? And he put it down to what they ate. And what they ate was a lot of fermented foods containing lactic acid bacteria. Now, and so if you go to Korea, you can get a yogurt drink with Metchnikoff's picture on it, and therefore don't have this Nobel sign of approval, so it must be good for you. But, you know, Metchnikoff was ahead of his time, and this was more or less ignored for many, many years. Studies from my colleagues in Cork a number of years ago showed that people, elderly people that were in good health, they had a very different microbiome composition than those who were quite frail. And so they put down that this may play a role, and they were wondering, well, why, what is the main factor? And the main factor that they put it down to was what they ate. Because those that ate a diverse diet, rich in green vegetables and high in fish and diversity, that their microbiomes were much, much more diverse. Than those that had a very everyday kind of diet. And unfortunately, those with this everyday routine diet often lived in nursing homes, and they were getting these white foods that were quite stodgy and repetitive, whereas those that lived in the community had a much healthier and diverse diet, and therefore a diverse microbiome. And this is really what goes back to what Mexico.
Okay, so understand what's being said here is the microbiome is greatly influenced, of course, by what you eat. And so if you eat a kind of bland diet with not much variety, you're reducing the diversity of your microbiome. And it turns out that a more diverse microbiome is health-promoting, and a less diverse microbiome is health compromising. So the idea would be to eat as diverse a diet as you can, rather than a bland and entirely similar diet, okay? And this is in old people, that are older people, where they're seeing this great difference, depending on the diet.
The cop was saying, we've been revisiting Metchnikoff's ideas in some of our studies in animals to show that in aging, there is an increase in intestinal permeability, there is a change in inflammation, and changes at the microbiome level. And can we do anything? Well, that's something that we're looking at right now. And this is, again, an animal study that we've been working on. And in this study, we focused on middle age, maybe because I'm there, and I should be worried about it. But in middle-aged animals, you find that there is a real increase in neuroinflammation in the brain, and this often precedes neurodegeneration. And so we wanted to see if through targeting the microbes by diet, could we do this? And we did this by a prebiotic that contains inulin. Now, inulin is very high in a number of vegetables, including leeks and chicory. And so we're able to really slow down the neuroinflammation that occurs in middle age, but by feeding these animals with an inulin-rich diet.
Okay, so inulin slows down
neuroinflammation, that is inflammation in the brain, which precedes neurodegeneration in the brain. So in animals anyway, at this point, you're gonna go further, but in animals, if you feed them an inulin-rich diet, they slow this process down. So what's an inulin-rich diet? He's gonna describe it, but the two things you could definitely put down are leeks and chicory. I have no idea what they are, but actually I sort of do, but they seem to work to slow down neuroinflammation. So let's look at, he's gonna go further because I'm about people now, okay? And what to do to slow this neurodegenerative process down.
And so therefore, maybe for that little midlife crisis, rather than getting the motorbike, my colleagues and I would say maybe get some leaks instead. It might be better for you. One of the big conundrums we have in the field is how is all this happening? How do signals from the gut and the microbes get to the brain to modify how we behave? And we're only at the beginning of trying to figure this out, and it will take some time. One of the key pathways involves the vagus nerve. Vagus comes from the Latin for wandering. So this wandering nerve sends signals from our brain to all of our organs and from our organs all the way back to our brain. It is the key circuit recruited during mindfulness training. And a number of years ago, again in an animal study, we showed that when you cut this signal, this vagus, all of the effects of a bacteria, in this case the lactobacillus, were gone. So it tells us, as I like to remind people, that what happens in vagus doesn't just stay in vagus, but will actually affect our emotions in many ways. And this is just one pathway about how microbes can signal to the brain. There are many others, and we're trying...
Okay. So the vagus nerve is a big deal these days, as you know. And the vagus nerve connects the 10th cranial nerve. It goes out of the brain and goes down and connects all the organs of the torso. And it sends signals from the brain down, and it sends signals from these organs up to the brain. And what he's saying is if you cut this, you cut the influence of the microbiome on the brain in animals. So that's one important route for how this, the dialogue between the gut and the brain happen, is through the vagus.
To look at another important factor about the microbes is that there are little factories producing all kinds of weird and wonderful chemicals that our bodies wouldn't have otherwise. They take substrates from our diet and they basically turn them into really important chemicals like sialic acid, like short-chain fatty acids. And we're trying to undercover the relative contribution of these in terms of how our diet is shaping what's going on in our brain. So I mentioned that stress, especially in early life, affects the microbiome. That mice that lack the microbiome have deficits in how to deal with stress. And that leads us to good modulation of the microbiome and beneficial effects. And this brings us to the concept of a psychobiotic. This is a term we coined in Cork, and it's basically expanded to be any way of targeting the microbiome for mental health benefits. And there are different ways. We mentioned some of them already, like probiotics and prebiotics, fermented foods. And you know, we're slowly beginning to see that this could be a completely new way of thinking about how to treat and manage psychological issues. But, you know.
Okay, so just because some of you can't read this, if you want to go find supplements, not only are there probiotics and prebiotics and fermented foods, which many of you know are important, but there are also postbiotics, parabiotics, and synbiotics. I have no idea what those are, but if you Google them, I'm sure you can buy them.
How do you spell syn?
S-Y-N. Synbiotics. S-Y-N.
So it's over 30 years, and I put this in as a reminder, since the singer Tracy Chapman was singing about fast cars and revolutions. A And at that time, in terms of managing some of the key mental disorders like depression and anxiety, there haven't been much breakthrough. And so perhaps it's time for a new revolution in this regard. And so we coined this the psychobionic revolution. So this is a book we've written just to try to say that we're at the beginning of something completely new in terms of how we might manage our psychological well-being and managing brain health. Not to be any evidence that this might work. And we're all the time trying to expand the evidence that we have. We did a small study a number of years ago where we gave normal, healthy people a bacteria that came to our animal studies, a bifidobacteria among them, and they took this for a month, and then we stressed them in the lab, and lo and behold, that they had a reduced stress response, they had a better cognitive performance, and when we looked at their EEG responses, this was quite a marked signature. And these were normal people without any other problems. And it was quite exciting to see this because, you know, to be able to translate from basic research into the human side is really good. More recently, Paul Inge's group in Tübingen, they came to us and said, well, they wanted to test it in their brain imaging studies. And so they put individuals in the scanner and made them do what's called the cyberball task, which some of you may know. It's basically a task in virtual reality where you're passing the ball to two other people, and suddenly they start playing without you. And your brain doesn't like that. You're being excluded. You're being threatened. And your brain in the scanner starts mounting the threat response. Well, not if you're on this probiotic. And that was really, really intriguing and bolsters this whole approach. But not everything is going to work. And for example, we took our most exciting probiotic lactobacillus, and we tested it in the same way, and you cannot get more negative data into one paper if you try. It did absolutely nothing. And so, but I guess, you know, that's why we do research. And not everything that works in animals is going to work in humans, and this is really important. So, probiotics or specific strains are one way of having the psychobiotic approach. Another way, and no microbiome talk is complete without mentioning, is fecal microbiota transplantation. Taking someone else's poo. Really? How many of you would do this? I mean, there are a few. It varies. Well, you would if you had Clostridium difficile infection. Studies a number of years ago from the Netherlands showed that there was a 90% efficacy of this in C. diff, and C. diff kills people. And so there are not that many examples in medicine where we have 90% efficacy. It's now being, and it seems like something quite new, but it goes back to ancient China when Qihong was using it to treat his people with severe diarrhea. It's disrupting what our concept of what a medicine is. It's disrupting how we challenge our microbiome. People are coming up with new ways to deliver this medicine. These are the crapsules that are being used. So it's been used in Crohn's disease and tried in irritable bowel syndrome and expanding its repertoire across different ways. And we're hoping to collaborate with some colleagues here in Australia to do a study in relation to psychiatry in the future as well. What we have done is we've taken the microbiome from depressed individuals and transplanted into animals. And very surprisingly, we were able to emulate many of the behavioral phenotypes of depression into these animals. And so it tells us that there's something in this microbiome which is mediating what's going on in depression.
Okay. So I understand this a little different way, but it's kind of convincing. You take the microbiome of depressed mice and you put it into healthy mice, and the healthy mice get depressed. What?
The people to the mice.
Say again?
Isn't it from the people to the mice?
No, I think it's from the mice.
He said people.
Yeah. He said people? Oh, okay.
And look at the air.
Yeah, you're right. That's true. Okay, so if they take the microbiome of depressed people and they put them into healthy mice, and then the mice get depressed.
Right.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
No. Healthy people biome reverses depression.
No, that's not what they found.
No.
We'll go back.
Okay. I have a whole book on.
Okay, but that's not what he's saying.
Here, the same with overweight, the microbiome of someone overweight will make a skinny person overweight.
Overweight, okay. Mm-hmm.
And the reverse, if they put it from a skinny person into an overweight person,
it will bring the weight down. Okay. So again, what he said, he just talked about this first case. He didn't talk about these other cases. So let's listen to him again. But it's good to hear that it's been done with other things in other ways. Let's go to that. Okay.
And we're hoping to collaborate with some colleagues here in Australia to do a study in relation to psychiatry in the future as well. What we have done is we've taken the microbiome from depressed individuals and transplanted it into animals. And very surprisingly, we were able to emulate many of the behavioral phenotypes of depression into these animals. And so it tells us that there's something in this microbiome which is mediating what's going on in depression. I want to mention about diet, because another way that people are exploring the relationship between the microbiome and health is kind of cross-cultural studies. So people are going out to the Hadza community in Tanzania and showing that their microbiome is really, really diverse. And that's due to their high-fiber diet. And then you can see, well, what has agriculture done to our microbiome? Well, it's actually started to diminuate the diversity with the introduction of our culture practice that we can see in their varying populations today. And then in our Western society, and it's not just the US, it's in Ireland and it's in Australia, with the introduction of processed food, the introduction of antibiotics in the food chain, the increase in stress overall, we have an extinction of our microbiome. And so we don't know what the long-term consequences this has on.
So you just to underline it, did you get this?
Yeah. No.
Microbiome has become less diverse over time. We went from hunter-gatherer to agricultural societies, and current society, especially because there's a lot of antibiotics around and there's a lot of fast food around, our microbiome is way less diverse. You would think more because we have all that stuff in the supermarket, right? But apparently not.
On our brain health. We know in these other cultures there is no inflammatory diseases that we see in our Western world, and so perhaps this also will play a role. And what we're trying to do is triangulate the relationship between our diet, our microbiome, and brain health, and really try and disentangle the relative contributions of these and how they influence each other moving forward. There's exciting work emerging in the depression field. This is a study out of Belgium this year where they showed that in a large cohort of individuals, this was 1,000 people, that the quality of life scores and their depression was correlating with specific changes in the microbiome. They verified this in a second cohort of 1,000 people in Groningen and were able to also link quality of life scores with the microbiome. And so perhaps, if we start looking at depression and other psychological problems as an unholy trinity, this is my Irish-ism, if you want, of stress, inflammation, and the microbiome, and that if we want to manage it or fix it in some way, we may need to tackle all of these. And in terms of psychology, as a discipline is really getting very excited about the microbiome, both at the physiological level, of course, but at interpersonal and interpersonal levels, and even, as I mentioned, related to cultural levels. It is really interesting to point out that in 1 month this year, the covers of the American and British Psychological Association magazines all were focused on the microbiome, as well as trends in cognitive science. But really, we're at the beginning, and that's where I challenge all of you to think about how it fits into your own practice and your own research to see where this mind-gut connection really brings things together. So we're back to Pinocchio. Remember at the beginning I talked about Pinocchio? Well, really the story of Pinocchio and Geppetto was one about control. And what I've also learned perhaps from my private life is that sometimes the person who's really in control is often the wife or partner of the person who thinks they're in control. And so, while Pinocchio or the brain might think it's in control, it's often the microbes that are really pulling those strings. And this is a really exciting field, as you can tell from my enthusiasm overall. we are, but we need to, there's a lot of risk with it, because it's so easy to hype it and to overhype it. And I don't know where we are on the hype cycle with the microbiome, but we're somewhere, only time will tell. Jonathan Eisen and UC Davis gives out the Overselling the Microbiome Award. That's not an award you want on your CV overall. A lot of the problems emerge from rodents versus humans, but really from correlation and causation. The microbiome field is one of the worst for mixing these up. And there's a great website called Spurious Correlations, where you can correlate the divorce rate in the state of Maine with the per capita consumption of margarine. So you can see if someone can hold a margarine to the butter, they can start an argument, they could have leaked off. Anyway, so that's where we're going with some of these studies. Lots of small, underpowered studies, lack of dietary information, lack of good psychological and psychiatric phenotyping. We need a lot more studies. We really need to get a mechanism. We are challenged by we don't know what a normal microbiome is. You can go to your GP and find out what your blood pressure or cholesterol is and see where it is on the normal range. We can't do that with our microbiome. That's challenging overall. But with the advancing citizen science platforms, we can find out what our microbiome was like when we're healthy and then chart it over time. And this is increasing. There's lots of focus now on personalized diets and interventions that may be able to do this. And there's lots of hype in the field. And I always tell people, beware and always look for evidence when people are trying to sell them anything to do with the microbiome. Because for a lot of things, there isn't right evidence. And the news can be wrong on this overall in terms of doing it. But the good news, and this is really one of my key take-home messages, is that unlike your genome, which all you can do is really blame your parents and your grandparents, there is potential for your microbiome to be modifiable. And therefore, as an individual, you can take agency over your own health and well-being in a way that genome science can't give us overall. And these are some of the things that I like to tell people about having a psychobiotic life. It's increasing your insulin.
Okay, so he's going to list it in two parts. So here's what you want to do if you want to make a healthier microbiome. Prebiotics, fibers and vegetables, artichokes, leeks, onions, and garlic. This is increase the intake of omega-3 fatty acids. Polyphenols, including nuts, seeds, coffee, dark chocolate, red wine, olive oil, and berries. Yogurt and fermented milk. Keeper, fermented foods, sauerkraut, kimchi, miso, and kombucha. Kombucha. Okay, so that's what you want to increase the intake of. Let's try this some more.
Slower.
Oh, it's going to stay up there.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah. I think it's going to add more now. So I'll leave this one up.
Take a picture.
Take some prebiotics, polyphenols, omega-3. And fermented foods are really good in this regard. Decreasing intake of processed foods, emulsifiers, sweeteners. Exercise is really good. Avoiding stress, jet lag. I'm the worst culprit in all of this myself. Avoid C-section as much as possible and support breastfeeding and minimize.
Okay, so he didn't make a big point of this, but breastfeeding is far superior to bottle feeding in terms of the microbiome. And minimize antibiotic usage. Not only yourself, but in the culture, because of the stuff we eat. So decrease intake of processed foods, emulsifiers, and sweeteners, and then exercise, avoid sleep and stress and sleep disturbances, avoid C-section and support breastfeeding, and minimize antibiotic usage. Okay. So somebody's got pictures of this, right? So we can, okay, good. So let's just finish up.
Antibiotic usage. And then there's one that I'm terrified to tell my wife and kids about, which is having a pet has been shown to really increase the diversity of your microbiome. So in conclusion, really, the goal in 20th century medicine was about, in microbial medicine, about killing germs. Now we know that we really have to protect our microbiome, to expose Donald Trump, to build a wall, to really mine our microbiome in some way, and that our state of gut will markedly affect our state of mind. Of course, this is not work I do alone. It's with a great group of people, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a molecular biologist, and neuroscientist in our group at Cork. A big shout out to my clinical colleague Ted Diamond, who helped us along the way. And finally, with Hippocrates, he's also supposed to have said, let food be thy medicine. I'm just going to change that a little bit and say, let food for your microbes be your medicine. And I leave you with the cartoon that the Daily Mail made about our work some time ago, the dreaded Daily Mail. Thank you very much.
Okay, so the cartoon
says the depression started when I realized how much I was spending on yogurts.
Okay, so I'll back this up and I'll leave that last slide on in case you didn't get it, and then I'll put the lights on. There it is. Okay.
I have something to add.
Okay, so when you go to lunch, think about what you're eating. Alright, so question or comment while people open up. So Michael first, then we'll take you both.
A few years ago, I found a great picture book at a store called Urban Outfitters on St. Street, and it talked all about monitoring our daily poop and using vision and smell, how we can adjust our diet and maybe our exercise, and just how to help your life.
I'm not going to take this around with people. So, this is it. Okay. So, make your comments brief. Okay?
I just want to know where the underbelly is.
You said